Welcome to Culturetopia, NPR's roundup of the week's very best arts and cultural stories. I am Netta Ulaby. This week on Culturetopia, you may have seen Jeff Bridges in movies like The Big Lebowski or True Grit. He won an Oscar for Crazy Heart, in which he played a country singer. Now he's released an album of country music. The movie The Help has stirred up controversy over its depiction of the civil rights movement, but nearly everyone seems to agree that actress Olivia Spencer is one of the best things about the movie. She plays one of the maids, and in this interview from Tell Me More, she responds to the film's many critics. And a remembrance of a Mexican comic legend. Cantinflas was described by Charlie Chaplin as the best comedian alive. He was born 100 years ago. But first.
Now news from the world of children's television. It's official. The most beloved pair of bachelors on TV are not gay.
Hey, Ernie, hey, the place looks great. Look at all the decorations.
Yeah, doesn't it look nice, Bert?
This week, thousands of people signed an online petition asking for Sesame Street's Bert and Ernie to get married. But as NPR's Netta Ulaby reports, PBS has released a statement that says the two are best friends, no more, no less.
The statement was very sweet. It says Bert and Ernie were created to teach preschoolers you can be good friends with people who are very different from you.
Ernie, I don't mean don't eat all that. Ernie!
Honestly, my first reaction to this was that I was glad that they're not making Bert and Ernie a married couple because, frankly, I think Bert can do better.
That's Time Magazine's TV critic, James Poniewozik.
Ernie's kind of a jerk to Bert. You know, he tricks him, he lies to him, he steals his pizza. It's not, you know, a loving adult relationship to me, frankly.
Ernie!
Bert deserves, you know, a nice man who's going to treat him right.
Ernie, tell me. How do I look?
With your eyes, Bert.
Somewhere Jim Henson is laughing, just laughing.
Kate Clinton is a lesbian comedian. She says if we're going to go ahead and project things onto hand puppets, she's going to project Bert and Ernie as being so radical, they're standing up for gay people's freedom to not get married.
You know, like in New York, people are like, before they even say hello, they're like, are you getting married? And you're like, oh, could you back up?
See, this is an important lesson for children. Don't pressure gay people to get married. Obviously, public television needs to tread carefully politically, says James Poniewozik, given its, history. The network that brought us Tinky Winky also said in its statement that puppets do not have sexual orientation, which, as James Poniewozik points out, does not exactly stand up to scrutiny.
Elmo has a mom, obviously, which does sort of raise the philosophical and biological question of little Muppets needing to come from somewhere.
But some mysteries are best left unplumbed. The real shame, says Poniewozik, is that parents like him who watch Sesame Street with their kids will now be denied that little frisson of are they or not.
I like you.
Netta Ulaby, NPR News.
The movie adaptation of the best-selling book, The Help, roared into theaters this week, racking up more than $5 million in box office receipts its opening day. It closely follows Catherine Stockett's novel about life among the white, well-to-do women of 1960s Jackson, Mississippi. The book told that story in large part from the point of view of the black women who serve them, something that earned Stockett both praise and condemnation. The Help is set against the civil rights era, and the drama begins when the junior league queen bee, Hilly Holbrook, takes a stand against the maids using their employer's bathrooms. One of her friends defies Hilly and tries to get two of the maids, played by Viola Davis and Octavia Spencer, to tell the world what their lives are really like.
All right, I'm gonna do it. But I need to make sure she understands this ain't no game we playing. Slide your chaplain under that table. Face me. I need to see you square on at all times. I got to come up with your questions, too?
Oh.
That's Octavia Spencer playing the feisty maid named Minnie, and she practically steals the show with crisp dialogue and an arsenal of explosive facial expressions. And she joins me now to talk about the filming of The Help. Octavia Spencer, welcome to the program.
Well, hello, and thank you for having me.
If you've read this book, you know Minnie well, but for those who haven't, could you describe this character?
Sure. Minnie is a short, robust woman. She's the best cook in Jackson and therefore sought after for her cooking prowess, but she is also obstinate and very opinionated and doesn't have a problem, you know, expressing those opinions, especially to white people, which was a no-no during that time period. And that's her outward life. Her inward life and her home life, she is an abused wife and mother of five.
There's a lot that you do through your body language in this film, and you are able to reflect certainly good humor in many cases, and a certain relaxation around some of the characters. The woman Celia that you wind up working for, who lives on the outskirts of town because people have been spreading things about you in town. But you also carry yourself in a very erect way that reflects both pride but also a good deal of pain when you're dealing with some of the more difficult characters.
Absolutely. She is always standing tall when she's dealing with Hilly, because she emotionally wants Hilly to know that, you know what, you're not superior to me. But when she's with Celia, I think it's just that she's relaxed. And when she's with her children, when she sends her daughter off to work for that first time, that, if anything, crushes her. And you definitely see the shift in her posture, because now what she has dreaded more than anything, her daughter following in her footsteps, is happening.
And she's telling her daughter the do's and don'ts, and her daughter, too, is wearing the uniform.
Yes.
For Minnie, the life that she's consigned to is like a girdle that's mm-hmm. a few sizes too small. She can't wait to break out of it, but until then, it's just sort of cutting her up. What did you have to do to get in that frame of mind? And was it a bit disorienting to go in and out of that as you're filming during the day and then you're back in 2011, 2010 at the end of the day?
I did a lot of research about the time period and spent some wonderful hours talking to Miss Merle Evers Williams, and I watched the documentary Eyes on the Prize. I really basically never really came out of the 60s. It's hard to go in and out.
And you mentioned Merle Evers. She was married to Medgar Evers, who lived in Jackson, Mississippi, and was killed. He was gunned down in front of his home, actually during the period when this story takes place. Octavia, I have to be honest, viewing some of this was very difficult, because it does snatch you back to a very difficult time. And somehow, often a book can be more evocative in one's mind than a movie. But in this case, actually seeing the actresses being inside some of those places makes the viewing very, very tough. And it's, you know, one person's mammy is another person's mama. Were you aware of that when you were filming this? And I'm wondering if you wanted in some way to make the film unsettling, to make sure that the audience, yes, laughed at times, but also shifted in their seats because they weren't exactly comfortable with everything they saw.
Well, I think it's important to point out that the book and the film, while they're set during the civil rights movement, it's not necessarily a civil rights movie. To me, it's more of a movie about relationships and how these white women relate with each other, and then how they relate to the women in their homes who work in their homes. So what I take from that, the discomfort, and I think it's important that we feel the discomfort, because people lived this discomfort, and we can step out of it for, you know, for the 2 hours that you sit and watch what's happening on the screen. I think it's pretty much one of the things that we owe to these women, you know, because they did live it. And the other thing is, I think it's a feel something movie. You feel as much of the discomfort and the pain that you see Abilene and Minnie endure, but also you feel proud of them and triumphant and laughter and joy and maybe a little guilt. So there's the gamut of emotions that you feel, not just the discomfort.
I want to give you an opportunity to address something directly. If you follow people on social media right now, on Twitter, on Facebook, and other things, there's a big, robust discussion about this film and, once again, about the book. And there are some people who are suggesting that people not see this film. They say that they're not interested in it. They don't like the point of view that it's told. They don't want to look back at history through this particular lens. I want to give you an opportunity to address them. What would you say to them?
Well, quite honestly, that puts me in an awkward position because I'm an actor saying, you know, go see the film. But what I will say to that is, if it's that they don't like the fact that a white woman wrote it and used a African-American dialect, I take issue with that because what message are we sending to artists? If it's that black women are playing maids in 2011, I would say these are not the same maids that you saw in every other film about this era. For the first time, these women have a voice and these women are proactive in bringing about change in their community. So there are going to be people who are going to want to see this movie. There are going to be people who are sitting on the fence about seeing this movie. I would say make your own judgment. If you haven't read the book and all you are going on is what someone else says, then are you really going to let someone else make up your mind to not see the film at all because you think it represents something derogatory? I say then it's your loss because it's a wonderful film.
Octavia Spencer stars in the film The Help. Octavia, it's been great talking to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Yesterday would have been the 100th birthday of the Mexican comic legend known as Cantinflas. Charlie Chaplin once called Cantinflas, whose real name was Mario Moreno, the best comedian alive. He died in 1993 after making 50 films, most of them in Spanish. In Hollywood, he won a Golden Globe for his performance in Around the World in 80 Days. Producer Lily Percy looks back.
Mario Moreno was born August 12, 1911, in a working-class neighborhood in Mexico City called Tepito. He got his start performing in carpas, or tent theaters, Mexico's version of vaudeville. That's when he created the nonsense nickname Cantinflas, and the character that would define him, an endearing, fast-talking vagabond. Cantinflas began his film career in the mid-1930s, but it wasn't until 1940 that he broke out in the movie Allí está el detalle, or There's the Rub.
A movie that if you have never seen Cantinflas would probably be a good place to start.
That's Gregorio Luque. He's an expert in Mexican art and culture based in Long Beach, California.
Cantinflas plays, again, you know, this vagrant lowlife that has a girlfriend who is the maid of a wealthy home. And so you see Cantinflas speaking with the maid, and the maid complains that he doesn't work and that he's just good for nothing and that they will never get married. And Cantinflas responds to her that, who says that work is a virtue? Has she ever seen any rich man work? If working were a good thing, the rich would work too.
His character in the film, also called Cantinflas, talks like Groucho Marx, but looks a little like a famous English movie tramp.
He is the Mexican Charlie Chaplin.
That's Mexican-American writer Sandra Cisneros. She remembers seeing Cantinflas movies as a child with her parents in Chicago.
And, you know, you can never keep up with these Cantinflas movies because it was all about him speaking so quickly. He was famous for cantinfliando, you know, making words and bending them all around. So the audience would laugh, and I got used to these explosions of laughter, not always following the humor, but just watching the story and liking him because he was very likable.
Cantinflas found himself breaking box office records at crowded theaters in Mexico, as well as all over Latin America. Soon Hollywood came knocking, but it wasn't until 1956 that he found a role that let Cantinflas be Cantinflas. The movie was Around the World in 80 Days, and he played the scene-stealing valet to Englishman David Niven.
It's not Sunday. It's Saturday. We have 10 minutes left.
What the everlasting blazes are you jabbering about?
It's Saturday. Look for yourself. It's Saturday.
The film was a smash. It won the Best Picture Oscar that year, and Cantinflas collected the Golden Globe for Best Comic Actor. It was the highlight of his English-language career, but he continued to rule in the Spanish-language world.
The language that Cantinflas uses is really all about puns.
That's University of Minnesota history professor Jeffrey Pilcher. His focus is on Mexican cultural history, and he wrote a book on Cantinflas. And it was those puns, he says, that made Cantinflas so hard to translate for the U.S. market. Not so for audiences outside Mexico, though, from Colombia to Chile.
Because his humor was so chaotic, so incomprehensible, I think it allowed people to, even if they didn't get the specific references from that Mexico City dialect, they sort of placed their own jokes in his mouth.
Cantinflas continued to make movies in English and Spanish well into the 1980s and even earned a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. A year before his death in 1993, the Bible of Spanish language, the Real Academia Española, added a verb in his honor, cantinflear, which means, appropriately, talking without saying anything. And his movies are still a touchstone for Latinos. Or, as Jeffrey Pilcher puts it,
sort of the way that The Wizard of Oz is in the United States.
Mario Moreno would have turned 100 years old yesterday. For NPR News, this is Lily Percy.
Estas son las mañanitas que cantaba el rey David a las muchachas bonitas se las cantamos aquí si el sereno de la esquina me quisiera hacer favor de apagar su linternita mientras que pasa.
The actor Jeff Bridges is moving into a job he once had on screen. By playing a country singer in Crazy Heart, he explored his own passion for music.
The wonderful thing about acting, or one of the great things, is that you can use all of your, you know, talents and interests in your work.
Now Bridges has recorded an album with some of the same people who helped him to portray a musician.
I've been loved and I've been alone. All my life I've been a rolling stone.
That's Bridges from the Crazy Heart soundtrack, and this is from his new album called Jeff Bridges.
I'm driving my blue car, baby, down from the mountain so high. I'm driving my blue car, baby, coming down, gonna say goodbye.
We found Jeff Bridges in Austin, Texas, where he was preparing for a concert. He sat down with a cup of coffee to talk about his transition from acting to music. You supposedly aspired to be a musician before you were an actor. Is that true?
Yeah, probably so. You know, my father, Lloyd Bridges, unlike a lot of actors, really encouraged all his kids to go into showbiz. He loved it so much. And like most kids, you know, you don't want to do what your folks want you to do. You got your own things, you know.
So if I talked to you when you were 14 or 16 and said, what do you plan to do when you get out of here, you'd say, I intend to be a musician.
Yeah, musician or artist. I was also interested in painting and still am. And the acting thing was fun, but... you know, I had some problems with the whole nepotism thing, you know, getting into it just because that's my dad, you know, had the inroad.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's really huge in Hollywood, isn't it? That's just...
Oh, well, that's the toughest thing, you know, about the acting profession is getting that break, and that was pretty much handled for me. So that road became the one of least resistance. But fortunately, I've kept the music thing going, so I'm happy about that.
So that's what went horribly, horribly wrong, is movies just worked for you first.
Horribly, horribly right, I'd have to say. I'm glad I finally got with the old man's program. He was right.
Bridges' new album grows out of the singing that he did in several films. He sings two songs by the late country musician Stephen Bruton, who worked with him on Crazy Heart.
I know that you've been feeling down and blue.
We all looked towards Stephen for authenticity, you know, because the life of Bad Blake, the character that I played in Crazy Heart, was very much like the life that Stephen led. Mm-hmm. So he could, you know, he could tell us, you know, hey, yeah, you know, when I'm driving a long time, I don't want to pull over to the side of the road. I got to get somewhere, so I'll just carry an empty Sparkletts bottle and, you know, piss in that if I have to.
Which is an opening scene in Crazy.
That's the opening scene in Crazy. But that's like, one example of the kind of input that he had. But he also, you know, taught me how to play guitar. You know, helped move me up the next level on my guitar playing, and singing, and writing songs. You know.
Take your time, listen. Fix you with a remedy that's tried and true.
like writing your own music for this release?
Well, some of the songs are from quite long ago. Falling Short is, oh gosh, it could be 30 years old, you know, 40 years old, I don't know, something like that. Hmm. But it still sort of applies to me.
Let's listen to a little bit of that.
Am I falling short, or do I fly? While I miss the mark, do I hit the sky? In my wondering, do I answer why I'm alive?
What did you mean when you said that song applies to you in some way?
Oh, you know, I find that I'm pretty critical of myself as far as reaching some sort of perfect bullseye or target that I'm aiming for, you know. And sometimes you can get so obsessed with that bullseye that you miss the whole deal, you know, because you're just so focused on what you think is perfection that you miss what really is perfection, which is just being alive, you know?
You want to, you're just saying, dodge the wrath of myself and leave the math to God?
Yeah, yeah.
Dodge the wrath of myself and leave the math to God.
Has it occurred to you the last couple of years that if you'd been a little more stubborn, if you'd insisted a little more on your own way, if you could have ended up being a little bit like the character that you played in Crazy Heart, you know, somebody whose name is known but not that famous and driving around, driving himself from venue to venue, singing songs where he could get work?
Go on.
I'm just wondering.
Do I fantasize about it?
No, I don't know about fantasizing. Whether you've wondered about whether that could have been your life.
Yeah, I don't know how long I would be alive if that was my life. I don't know. I think it worked out just right, man. I'm really happy the way it worked out. You know, life is having its way with me now. I'm really pleased because I'm getting to now kind of shift gears now that, you know, this last year I decided to put the acting aside and concentrate on my music, and that has felt really refreshing and good.
Well, Jeff Bridges, thanks very much. I've enjoyed this.
Nice hanging with you, man.
You can never make.
We go to the U.S.-Mexico border, at least as it's been seen in one famous movie. Orson Welles set his 1958 thriller Touch of Evil in an imagined border town. And NPR's Claudio Sanchez was no fan of the film when he began reporting on it. Here's what he discovered for our series On Location, about movies and their sense of place.
The first time I saw Orson Welles' Touch of Evil as a teenager, I hated it. The U.S.-Mexico border, after all, is my home, my true home. A place that Touch of Evil depicted in the worst possible light. Permissive, sleazy, ominous. Then there's the film's casting. Charlton Heston as a Mexican? Give me a break. Even Henry Mancini's moody Afro-Cuban score is geographically misplaced. Most people on the Mexican border are more likely to listen to norteño, mariachi, even country music. Clearly, setting Touch of Evil in Los Robles, a fictional border town, allowed Welles to manipulate lots of things.
It's what he imagines a border town to be.
Jimmy Mendiola is an independent filmmaker who admits to having a love-hate relationship with Touch of Evil.
The opening scene tells us a lot. I mean, it's that scene everybody talks about, which is that three-minute shot.
The camera zooms in on a man holding a kitchen timer taped to several sticks of dynamite.
A close-up of a bomb being put in the car, and then the car drives around, and we kind of get this introduction to the border city.
In that shot, considered one of the most audacious, breathtaking tracking shots ever filmed, the camera pulls up and away, panning rooftops and dark alleys as it follows the unwitting victims in the convertible fishtail Cadillac meandering through the streets of Los Robles.
And the way it's shot, you know, it's black and white, high contrast, kind of raw, and it kind of all contributes to this, you know, this anxiety that I'm sure people felt about Mexicans and the border. It's a dangerous place. It's kind of exotic. It's very sexy.
As the car approaches the U.S. port of entry, Charlton Heston and Janet Leigh walk into the scene. Heston, made up to look darker with a razor-thin mustache, plays Ramon Miguel Vargas, a Mexican federal narcotics agent. Leigh plays his Anglo wife, Susie. They walk arm in arm, the car with a bomb right beside them. They cross into the U.S. at the same time.
Mike, do you realize this is the very first time we've been together in my country?
Do you realize I haven't kissed you in over an hour?
Heston wraps his arms around Leigh's waist, kisses her, then... The Cadillac explodes. Just another murder mystery, another B-movie? Is that what Wells wanted Touch of Evil to be? Or was it to prove to Hollywood that he could take a mediocre story and turn it into a great movie? Another Citizen Kane, perhaps? Not quite, says Mendiola.
There's two ways to look at this movie from my perspective. Analyzing depictions of Mexican-Americans and Mexicans in the border, and then a more formal level of, like, you know, it as filmmaking. You know, he's a great filmmaker, and so he found the subject matter that perfectly fit his stylistic interests.
Mendiola raises a good point. Wells did not set out to do a documentary about the border. Besides, Universal Studios didn't want him to shoot anywhere near Mexico, so he settled on Venice, California. Because, as Wells would later say, it looked convincingly run down and decayed. In Los Robles, Mexicans are, for the most part, one-dimensional, thuggish, amoral, except for one, Miguel Vargas.
Once you change the protagonist to a Mexican, now you have the Mexican who's basically the hero of the film, and that is very rare.
Charles Ramirez Berg grew up in El Paso, Texas. He teaches film at the University of Texas in Austin and wrote Latino Images in Film.
And I know Charlton Heston is not Latino and he has to play a Mexican and all that kind of stuff. But still, the idea that you have the leading star in this film playing a Mexican and it's the Mexican who's the hero, that's Orson Welles just changing things up and just making it that much more powerful.
I suppose that is powerful. Vargas isn't just a good Mexican, he's an educated Mexican, in a Hollywood movie in 1958. It also had not occurred to me that in the novel the film was based on, Heston's character is Anglo, not Mexican. In other words, Wells intentionally made Vargas the antithesis of Hollywood's portrayal of Mexicans. The American police captain, Hank Quinlan, on the other hand, is a morally contemptible man played by Wells. He's in charge of the car bomb investigation. Ramirez says the crux of the story is that Quinlan embodies evil.
So it's about a dishonest cop, and it's even worse because he's the most celebrated cop, and everybody thinks he's a hero, and yet he is thoroughly corrupt. And on top of that, he's racist.
That actually was another thing that bothered me about Touch of Evil. Of course there are racists on the U.S.-Mexico border, but the underlying racism tends to be subtle, veiled in paternalism. Not always blatant or obvious. Back in Los Robles, as Quinlan's investigation into the car bombing unfolds, a lowly shoe salesman named Sanchez, yes, that's right, Sanchez, surfaces as the main suspect. In this next scene, an entourage of law enforcement types led by Quinlan and Vargas shows up at Sanchez's apartment on the U.S. side to interrogate him.
No deben hacer eso. No tienen ningún derecho de leer mis cartas.
They rifle through his private letters. Sanchez complains in Spanish. Don't speak Mexican, Quinlan barks. He slaps Sanchez when he does one more time.
That scene particularly exposes the vulnerability of minorities in such a situation.
UT film professor Charles Ramirez Berg.
Minorities have no say, no rights, no nothing. And that's the way, you know, Quinlan wanted it, and that's the way it's going to go down.
Quinlan has planted several sticks of dynamite in Sanchez's apartment to make it look like he was the bomber. Vargas confronts Quinlan for planting evidence.
In any free country, a policeman is supposed to enforce the law, and the law protects the guilty as well as the innocent.
Our job is tough enough.
It's supposed to be. It has to be tough. A policeman's job is only easy in a police state. That's the whole point, Captain.
A Mexican cop lecturing a U.S. cop about the presumption of innocence in a democracy. Why not? Then it hits me. Wells has turned the prevailing view of the Mexican border on its head. It's as if I'm seeing Touch of Evil for the first time through a new prism. Even the absurdity of Charlton Heston as a Mexican now seems more tolerable. As film experts Jimmy Mendiola and Charles Ramirez Berg have noted, Wells, to his credit, subverted expectations. And just in case you've been wondering about the bomber, Well, Quinlan's instincts were right all along. Sanchez, the shoe salesman who Quinlan tried to frame, was the bomber. Although, when the film ends and credits roll, I think maybe Wells should have ended Touch of Evil with a scene in which Vargas tries to explain the Mexican border to his wife, Susie.
This isn't the real Mexico, you know that. All border towns bring out the worst in a country.
That's the one thing that people who grew up on the border, including me, will agree is true, for the most part. From Orson Welles' Imaginary Mexican Border, Claudio Sanchez, NPR News.
That's it for this week. You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. I am Neda Ulaby. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. So long.